Good afternoon. I'm going to call the Thursday, March 13, 2004 AMATS Technical Advisory Committee meeting to order. I believe we have a quorum. So we'll move on to the minutes. One thing before we get started, minutes, I need to mention, would everybody please give your name when you make a motion or for discussion or anything so we can get that on. Okay, I need a motion to approve the minutes of the January 23rd meeting.
Gasper, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we'll move on to item number three, the staff reports, the financial progress report. Mr. Zegarty.
Okay, thank you. Financial progress report was attachment 3A in your folders, and it takes us through the last day of February, February 28th, which is about two-thirds of the way through our fiscal year. Pleased to report we're in good shape financially. As of February 28th, we expended 60% of the agency budget, so we're in real good shape financially. I'd be glad to answer any specific questions you have, and otherwise recommend approval.
The appointment is approved.
Josh Rogers, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. On B, to the technical progress report, Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things I want to talk about. First, on the federal level, as many of you know, MAP 21 is coming to an end soon, which is our federal highway authorization. It's actually 202 days that the bill will be extinct. So we are looking at the highway fiscal cliff, if you will, to see what happens next. Many of you may have seen in late February, President Obama announced a $300 billion four-year infrastructure spending plan to replace MAP 21. Basically, $150 billion of that would be made up from corporate tax changes, I guess would be the best way to say it, which there's been some debate about what that exactly means, but essentially it would be $150 billion infused into the trust fund. Talking about basically what some of the options are, it's either this corporate tax, either keeping things the same, which would lead us into eventually default. There's also been some discussion on raising the gas tax. However, that seems politically infeasible. Representative John Micah said, for anyone that thinks about raising the gas tax, they must be spending too much time in a Colorado pot shop. So I think the likelihood of that happening is very slim. Just to give you a little bit of an example of what President Obama's bill or what the spending levels are. So MAP 21 was approved. It was about $105 billion for 2 years, roughly $52 billion a year, $52.5 billion a year. $300 billion over 4 years works out to more like $75 billion a year. So we're talking about quite a substantial increase versus what we're seeing right now. My understanding of what that would also include would be more Tiger Grant funding. Many of you are aware the Tiger Grant is a competitive grant at the federal level that communities and states can compete for, which I know a lot of congressional members also have an issue with that because they see that it's taking more control at the federal level and giving less to the states and the locals. So that's something that we'll be watching as we move forward. Also, kind of a timely thing with this, the Taxpayers for Common Sense and Smart Growth America recently released a report regarding highway maintenance and highway funding. Basically, what the report looked at was how much states as a whole have been spending on maintenance versus expansion of the roadway. And I think, as many of you know, our policies over the last 4 years, 5 years, have been fix it first and focus on preservation. What they're seeing at a national level, however, though, is that more money is still being put in to expansion than is to preservation. Between 2009 and 2011, states spent $20 billion on expansion, while they only spent $16 billion on maintenance. So that's an issue that is sort of interesting when you look at also comparative vehicle miles traveled as well as congestion. Both have remained flat. So we're basically spending a lot of money to expand roadways, even though on a national level our congestion is not changing. So the report raises a lot of really interesting issues. Just talking to Jason right before the meeting. We're going to send that out to all of our members. You can see some of the facts. It's also available at the smartgrowthamerica.org, and that'll be made available to you as well. But it's sort of interesting. I think it coincides a lot of what we've seen. We did our preservation report and had just recently released a press release regarding some of the things we've seen in our area as well about some of the challenges in the roadway system that we're dealing with. So this kind of encapsulates that at a national level. I don't know, Jason, do you want to add anything to that?
Oh, maybe just a couple additional thoughts, and this kind of ties what Curtis reported on that report on the ratio of maintenance to highway expansion nationally and also the new transportation bill. So if we were to get that $25 extra billion a year in the next transportation bill, that potentially, I don't know whether that means MPOs will get that much of a proportional boost, but there's potentially more funding for us to pass on at the local level. And because the funding's been pretty limited and tight, that's yet another reason, I think that you're all aware, that we did do things a couple years ago, like create the resurfacing program, put a lot more emphasis in our funding policy on system maintenance and preservation. And in last meeting, you saw the report we did on the state of our infrastructure, and we concluded that generally we're kind of holding our own in this region. The roads are being maintained pretty well, but we put some policy conclusions in there, but we have to kind of continue to be vigilant and make sure we invest in that. And then just one other thing along those lines, Jim Bowling from Kent just sent me a little bit earlier, he had looked at our resurfacing program since it was created back in 2007, and I wanted to give him credit because I wish I had looked at these numbers, but he looked at the average pavement condition rating of a project that's been applied to through AMATS. And so when we started the program, it was 64 was the average pavement condition rating. Now it's 59. So even though we have been investing in it, I think, you know, the roads that are being applied for are slightly worse, if you will, pavement-wise. And the program has been really popular. When we started it, there were six different communities applying for the resurfacing program. Last time we did this last fall, there were 18. And then also the total number of applications, we got 16 the first time we launched the resurfacing program. And most recently, we got 68. So I think it has been a really great program from our standpoint, and hopefully from yours, where we've been able to put not necessarily more total dollar value, but using the money we have a little bit better, more projects for more communities on those core maintenance needs. And I think with the cutbacks and some of the local government funding and state and federal funding continuing to be tight, you know, we're going to try to continue to prioritize that.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if I said this number, but they estimate that it's $45 billion nationwide is needed to bring all roads up to a state of good repair. So that's sort of the estimate, which basically would be about 1 year of the Highway Trust Fund, or what's been allocated through MAP 21 as it is right now. The last thing I wanted to talk about real briefly was the Safe Routes to Schools program. We did, the state just concluded a submission, so I think they were due March 3rd. I think this time around, AMETS probably wrote more letters of support than we ever have for projects and communities coming to us about this program. The other thing we found out, though, is that there are still a lot of school districts that aren't aware of this program. And one of the things that we want to do is figure out a way to maybe better reach out to school districts as well as to communities about both the school travel plans and then the infrastructure spending. But then also, this was the first time we received infrastructure applications. I believe Aurora was one for the Safe Routes to Schools program. And as our policies are set up right now, they don't currently fit very well in our system of how we grade projects, because usually they're a little bit more local and they're a little bit sort of a kind of a different analysis than what we would use on a normal basis. So what I was hoping to do was maybe put together a small group of, say, interested communities that might be willing to meet once or twice to discuss safe routes and maybe some ideas of what we could do from a AMATS perspective, how we should be supporting the program. I'd be curious to hear anyone's thoughts on that, or if they've run into any issues. If not, please come see me if you're interested after the meeting, because I think it would be really helpful to talk to some people about how we can make the program more effective through the AMAT system, and really looking at what we can do as an agency to either, is it helping with the school travel plans, or is it actually finding pots of money or reserving pots of money to put towards some of these sidewalk projects that currently don't fit very well in our program. So with that, if there is any discussion, be happy to hear it. If not, come see me afterwards and we can talk about that a little bit more. So.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you.
And that's federal fund reports, attachment 3 senior handout. Mr. Bodison.
Thank you. The fiscal year 2014 ending balance, I mentioned this at our meeting last time in January. We're over the thresholds that SOGOP has allowed for unspent funds to be carried over to the next fiscal year. So what we did was we talked to a couple of different FPOs in Ohio, Morrissey down in Columbus, and OPI in Cincinnati area. We were able to trade funds with them in the amount of $5.5 million. But I think our lapse amount was something closer to $7 million. So anyhow, with the remaining amount, I'm asking not to give you some exact numbers, but now that we traded over $5.5 million, that'll come back in 16, but the remaining $2 million we'll have to write a waiver for. Request ODOT to give us a waiver for it, which is permissible because we are saving up the project in the future. The new statewide CMAQ funding program, that process, we're finalizing the application for this new program. We have a meeting at the end of this month, so hopefully that will be finalized. If not, at the end of this month, sometime in April. So that means that probably in late April or even May, we'll start the process here at our local level. And this will be much like any of our other funding programs, where we'll send out a notice that there's funds available for CMAQ projects, and then we'll send out the application with it. We're going to skip the letter of intent phase on this when we do this here, just to save some time. Then when we get those back, it'll be much the same. That the TIP subcommittee will get together, we'll review the applications, score them, rank them, and then come up with a list of projects to recommend for funding. It'll come back to this committee and then the policy committee for final approval. Then once that list is done, we'll take that down to the statewide committee sometime in either August or September. And then by the end of this fiscal year, we should know which, that'll basically go in the hopper with all the rest of the projects from the state, and then we should know by the end of the year which ones are being funded. The recently approved projects for funding, by now, hopefully everybody has submitted their programming packages in to ODOT. We'll be getting together with them shortly to get bids on all those projects. And the next steps will basically be that ODOT will start setting up scope meetings. They'll go throughout the springtime and probably also into the summertime, too. Now, last thing I want to mention is our PCR subcommittee. We got together yesterday. If you recall, Summit County agreed to be the fiscal agent for this process. What we talked about yesterday was the details of how the contract would be set up with the Summit County and each of the individual communities, and as far as how the process would work. So in about a month or a month and a half, you should be seeing a letter from Summit County to describe the program and what some of the local share, what an estimated local share amount will be. And also with that, we'll come to frequently asked questions on about a three-page thing to kind of help explain some of the stuff going on. If you'll recall, what we want to get out of it as AMAPS is that we need to get the PCRs on the local federal aid system. So we've agreed to pay 80% of that cost, and then each community will pay 20% based on their lane miles in their community. But then there'd be options to that if the community wants to also do the state routes within their community, or if they want to get all their local roads, the PCRs on local roads, they can do that too. So that could be added on. Those two options would be 100% local funds, though. So I think what we talked about yesterday is basically hopefully Summit County will have all these contracts in place by the end of fall. Then they'll start the process. Once those are all in place, they'll start the process to hire a consultant. And then a little bit over a year from now, that consultant will be out on the street taking PCR values. And then they'll be done by the end of summer next year, right in time for us to start our next round of funding for resurfacing projects, and we'll have those new PCRs to work with. So that's all I have on this item. If anyone has any questions, we have to answer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bodison. No old business. We're going to move right on to new business. The draft 2010-12 pedestrian analysis, the key findings, is for discussion only. Mr. Pillay. Attachment 5B.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back in December, I presented a bicycle safety report, and at that time we promised you that we would also do the same thing with pedestrians, and that's what I'll be presenting today. This is our first attempt at something like this, and I must say it was very interesting to work on. A pedestrian is defined as any person traveling by foot, but for this report, it basically includes anybody in the street right-of-way, including those on skateboards, rollerblades, scooters, and wheelchairs. And this does not include bicycles. That was separate. One thing about pedestrians is most of us are probably pedestrians on a daily basis. When we walk to work, when we cross the street, at some point in time, we're pedestrians. The purpose of this report is to try to determine why and where these crashes are occurring, and it's another tool that we will use to better plan pedestrian facilities such as sidewalks and crosswalks. Pedestrian crashes have some unique characteristics. First of all, they have a real high percentage of injury. There's really not much protection between a pedestrian and a vehicle when they're when they collide. So there's a high percentage of injuries, 86%. Other crashes is 25%. They occur randomly and are kind of widespread. We don't have the 25 at one intersection type thing. Usually vary with population density, and usually a corridor or a systematic approach is most effective when trying to do countermeasures. Here's the map that was in the handout or in your packet. This is a map of the pedestrian crashes that happened in our area. It's a little hard to see on the screen because the color's not real clear, but the red dots are called young adults, ages 19 through 23. And it's a little hard to see, but you can see there's a cluster of them around Kent State, and there's also a cluster of them around the University of Akron. Probably college students, but there's no way of knowing for sure if someone in that age group is in fact a college student. The number of crashes varies somewhat from year to year. I fit a trend line over. I went back three more years and fit a trend line to just kind of see what they're doing. And as you can see, the trend line is slightly increasing. For 2010, 11, and 12, there were 459 pedestrian-related crashes in our AMATS area. When we started this project, the first thing we did was we downloaded the crash files from the Ohio Department of Public Safety. Then we used the document numbers from those files to actually get the police reports. Each report was reviewed, sometimes two or three times, and then we tried to kind of categorize the different types of crashes. And then within each category, we sometimes even try to dig a little bit deeper. The vehicle driver was faulted in 216 of the incidents, or 47% of the time. The most common driver citation was failure to yield. The pedestrian was faulted 154 times, and the most common pedestrian citation was darting into traffic and improper crossing. In 89 of the incidents, the fault was undetermined. He said, she said, by the time the police officer arrived. As mentioned earlier, high percentage of injuries, 86% or 359 injuries, 110 of those were incapacitating. And severity of the injury is related to the speed. And I found this interesting illustration showing that if a pedestrian is hit at 40 miles an hour, there's a good chance that it's going to result in a fatality. But you decrease that by 10 miles an hour to 30, and you have a pretty good chance of surviving, and even a slight chance of coming out uninjured. And then if you decrease that 10 more miles to 20 miles per hour, you have a very good chance, a 95% chance of surviving, and then a 30% chance of no injury. Unfortunately, over the 3 years, there were 14 fatalities. Pedestrian crashes are actually less than 1% of all the total crashes that happen, but they account for 10% of the fatalities. And 10 of those fatalities occurred in darkness, in dark conditions. One thing about pedestrians, they don't have lights on them. They don't have reflectors. They're just really hard to see in dark conditions. And to make that even worse, most of the time they're wearing dark-colored clothing. So here's a rundown of what happened. The most predominant pedestrian crash occurred at intersections, when a pedestrian was crossing the street at an intersection. 202 of those. 93 where the pedestrian was crossing the street mid-block. 60, the pedestrian was walking on the roadway. 34 where the pedestrian was hit at a driveway. People sometimes backing out of driveways, and sometimes the what I've noticed is the fancy entrance to the new development has a lot of landscaping, and it makes it hard to see a pedestrian. Miscellaneous, there were 20 miscellaneous ones. These were just real, I call them outliers. They were just strange accidents where a pedestrian was involved. And then it decreases quite rapidly. A few where a vehicle actually departed the road and hit a pedestrian on the sidewalk. Some police reports we couldn't even quite figure out. Pedestrian and skateboarders and rollerbladers in the street. People attending a disabled vehicle. Workers in the roadway. People standing in the roadway. And then even three people getting into a parked car.
Does this mean that the most dangerous place to cross the road is in an intersection?
No, we'll get into that in a little bit.
I was just going to say, along those lines, I think in some ways it is, because you've got all the conflicting turning movements, and I actually got, I won't call it hit, but the vehicle did touch me last week when I was crossing right in front of our office, and it was somebody turning right on red, and you know, I saw her inching up. I tried to make eye contact. She inched up a little bit more. I thought she saw me. I started to walk, and then she inched up again, and I slammed my hand down on her hood, which got her out of her reverie.
Did she drop her phone?
But it was there was no phone. But it was just one of those things. I think that's a really common occurrence with a car turning right on red, and they're not looking for somebody.
It does point to perhaps we need better attention to how we deal with the intersection, pedestrians at intersections. Yeah.
The top three categories, those accounted for 77% of all the incidents. Looking at the intersection crashes a little closer, once again, there were 202 of them. And then this table shows what the vehicle was doing, the direction the vehicle was turning. 80 of them were turning left, 68 were going straight through, and 39 were turning right, and 7 were stated they were turning right on red. Now, there quite possibly could have been more because, like Jason alluded to, when a person is turning right on red, they're looking to their left, and they're not looking at you crossing the street. So, but once again, a lot of these things may be happening, but if it wasn't like actually stated in the report, we just weren't sure. And then 15, it was we just couldn't determine. 78 of these intersection crashes occurred in marked crosswalks. Could have been more, but once again, 78, it was specifically stated. And pedestrian signal details were kind of sketchy. They didn't, a few of them were, it mentioned the pedestrian had a walk or a don't walk signal, but a lot of the reports, it just didn't mention what the signal was doing.
We'd be able to go look at those to see which intersections did have pedestrian signals, right? That could be something we did have done that.
We could always dig deeper. I mean, you can just keep digging and digging and digging into this data because there's just so much that there's a lot of information you can keep mining out of it, but we didn't do that yet. The next few slides, what I did was I took the pedestrian results and I compared them to what I found for bicycles. The pedestrian data is the blue bars, and there were some similarities, and then there were some interesting things that were different. Looking at the time of day, both pedestrians and bicycles, they had a morning peak around 7 to 8 a.m., and then they both peaked later in the day, around, between like 3 and 5. They had afternoon peaks. But something interesting I noticed is if you notice the bikes after like 7 o'clock, the bike incidents really fall off. And then bike incidents are really low through the night. But look what happens to pedestrians. Pedestrian incidents actually increase a little bit around 9 to 10 and between 10 and 11. And then you have an interesting spike here around midnight, and you have an interesting spike here around 2, between 2 and 3. Probably. Yeah. I can't say that for sure. But
that's when the bars close? You can't say that.
Well, I can say that's when the bars close, but I can't say all these people were coming out of those bars, but it's a very good suspicion.
Or the people in the cars were coming out of
the bars. Or the people in the cars. Here's the same thing by months of the year. Now, something interesting I found when looking at months of the year, once again, the blue bars are pedestrians. As you can see, spring is real high, and then it kind of goes down through the summer months. And as the pedestrian crashes go down through the summer months, the bicycle crashes go up. And then in the fall, the pedestrian crashes go back up, and the bicycle crashes go down. So they're kind of an inverse of each other. Pedestrian crashes peaked in October. Then there's a pretty good peak here in February also. The only thing I can conclude without looking deeper is school's in session, and maybe a lot of those are school-related. It's just hard to know without doing more research. And then here's age of pedestrians and bicycle riders that are in crashes. The bikers had a big peak here at the 5 to 14 year old category, and so did so did pedestrians. But then pedestrians really peaked here at 19 to 29 and 30 to 49. Kind of interesting. I expected more to be in this age group. But that's, once again, it's hard to know for sure why that, why so many, especially, now the 19 to 29-year-olds could be college students, but the 30 to 49-year-olds, it kind of baffled me why that was so high, other than maybe it's people out trying to walk and be healthy or run or whatever. I don't know for sure. Could be joggers. A few recommended countermeasures: construct, repair sidewalks and paved shoulders. If you have sidewalks that look like this, those pedestrians are going to be out here in the street. And you can see a nice, smooth, well-maintained sidewalk is inviting to pedestrians. I'm not real crazy about the paved shoulder. There's very little distance between the traffic and where it's at, but it's certainly better than nothing, especially in rural areas where there's a ditch and it just doesn't lend to sidewalks very well. These are also very useful for bicyclists and also for safety, just general vehicular safety. Use of walk crosswalks and marked crosswalks, enhancements, and islands. I put this picture in because this is an offset crosswalk. This when you go across this crosswalk, it makes you turn, and when you turn, you actually face the traffic that's coming at you. These are a couple examples locally. Raised pedestrian crossings. These have two primary purposes. They make the crosswalk very prominent, and then they also slow traffic down. I'm not sure how plow drivers feel about these. Lighting is important. Remember, the 10 of the fatalities happened in dark conditions. And keeping walks clear, especially this winter. I noticed I drive on Market Street, a very busy street, on a regular basis, and several times this year I've seen pedestrians in the street, a very dangerous situation. And education is very important. Know the pedestrian rules and laws, and Curtis just mentioned Safe Routes to School, a very good state program for grades K through 8. Begins with a school travel plan and then improvements. AMETS is actively involved in promoting pedestrian transportation. They feel it's an important component of the transportation system. And AMETS recommends that pedestrian facilities, if possible, should be part of highway projects, and communities should plan and build sidewalks and other pedestrian improvements. AMETS did an extensive sidewalk survey back in 2010, and one of the products from that survey was, or the inventory was, a regional transportation plan in 2012. It thoroughly documents existing conditions, best practices, recommendations, and then how to implement those recommendations. This entire plan is on the AMETS website. It's very well done and interesting. And the pedestrian safety analyses will also be posted on our website. I'm still polishing it up a little bit, but hope to have it up on our website in, by next week. And that concludes my presentation. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Comment. I think it's a very good start, and I think it points to the fact that a lot more needs to be done. I think it's a great move forward in looking at this, and Dave White is going to approve the.
Well, there's no approval needed at this time.
Okay, it's one requested.
I'm terribly sorry. That was a mistake on my part on the agenda that went to the committee members.
So do I have to withdraw my?
No, we still appreciate your support. And I was just going to add, I think Dave did a really nice job of giving you a feel for it. We're going to probably turn this into a more formal report, and then we will probably bring that back for approval. But just a couple other thoughts. Dave mentioned what's up on that slide, where we've done some kind of high-level strategic look at pedestrian issues. I think this crash data is going to enable us to take a little bit deeper dive at some locations. So a couple of the things I'm interested in having us do in the future is to look a little bit more closely, especially at those mid-block locations. Although, like you saw here, most of the crashes are in the intersections. We don't have data on this, but I suspect that the ones that are mid-block probably tend to be more serious, because they're probably vehicles that are going at a higher speed. And just knowing from experience walking around, if you are in an area where there's not a signalized intersection anywhere nearby, it's pretty tempting to cross the street. You know, you're not going to probably walk a half mile out of your way to get to a light. So I think we might take a look at potential mid-block crossing locations. It wouldn't have to be a light necessarily, but even having a marked crosswalk or some sort of yield to pedestrian sign or something like that. And then the other thing is, I think we will try to also look a little bit more at, are there some patterns geographically where they're occurring? Dave mentioned they're not as clustered. You know, he gave the example of, you don't get 25 in one spot like you do with the vehicle-to-vehicle crashes. A lot of that, though, I think is because you look at the vehicle miles traveled, there just aren't as many, you know, on foot as there are in car. But when you look at that map, there are definitely places there are certainly more than one pedestrian crash. So I think we're going to try to look a little bit more where are they clustered and things like that.
Thank you, Mr. Play. Okay, move on to number 6 on the agenda, the resolutions. First one is Resolution 2014-04, approving Amendment Number 11 to the Transportation Improvement Program, Fiscal Year 2014-17, at engineering phase to various projects to accommodate potential right-of-way services costs. We'll need a motion. There's a motion requested for this. It's Attachment 6A. Mr. Bodis.
Thank you. On some of our projects, as we're doing the design, they're able to do some of the activities from the right-of-way phase early on. What we do, Federal Highway calls that advanced authorization of funds for some of these activities. Up until now, we've been able to pay for those out of the right-of-way phase for their right-of-way activities. Federal Highway has not changed that once those monies come out of the engineering phase. So basically what this amendment does is takes the nominal amount out of the right-of-way phase and puts it in the engineering phase for it to be used for some advanced right-of-way activities. So it's more just a technicality that we need to do for TIP purposes. It doesn't add any more money to the projects. These listed here, these are all MS-funded projects. But again, the funding amount overall stays the same. And if it's not used in that phase, it'll go back to the right-of-way phase. So, with that, the staff recommends approval of Resolution 2014-04.
Dave, I move to approve.
Everybody second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, move on. Yeah.
Oh, and just to add one more thing to link this to the other item, I noticed looking at the table, 7 of these 10 projects include some type of sidewalk improvement. So thanks all of you, I think, for taking a look at a lot of the pedestrian improvements. And as Dave said, starting a lot of those at the local level, that is something we're trying to fund. And in this kind of random sample here, I think you already see that paying off.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to Resolution 2014-05, approving Amendment Number 12 to the Transportation Improvement Program, Fiscal Year 2014-17. To add 2 new projects, revise the funding to 3 existing projects, and revise the funding schedule and limits to 2 existing projects. Attachment 6B, Mr. Bodison.
Thank you. Okay, the 2 new projects, one is District 4, that's called the Wavetronics Signal Improvements. It's basically to install radar vehicle detection equipment on traffic signals at various locations in both Portage and Summit County. and this is going to use safety funds in fiscal year 2015. The other project is part of the larger I-76-77 Main Broadway project, but this, they created a separate project here for the demolition of structures. This would be in fiscal year 2015 using federal and state funds. As far as the existing projects, just to point out a couple of these, well, basically, it's just changing and revising some of the funding in the first three projects, and then the last two, Cleveland-Maslin Road, Phase 1, Phase 2. That is, it's all the same project. It was split up into two different phases, things because of the water line. It's going to be the same amount of funds for MAMAS. It's just going to be split up between, like I said, these two phases. So they had to create the second project, the second PID, so that they could deal with the water line issue. So with that, the staff also recommends approval of 2014-05.
Motion to approve. So moved, Gasper.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Do we have any other business? Okay. We'll go to the next regular meeting. It's going to be Thursday, May 8th, right here at the same place. And do I have any motion for adjournment? Second. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned.